you all for coming and supporting the conference. It's been a fun day. On a couple of days. I don't know this lady very well, but I was given her tape when I when it was time to decide who it was I wanted to have, but we all as a group wanted to have choose a speaker. And I laughed a lot because while I was listening to her tape. So it's been our goal to make this a light, easy, fun conference this year. So with that, I introduce Mary R. from
right now. Mary Alcoholic. Glad to be here. I want to thank Art. Was that so funny? It's fucking funny. And, I'm going to take this off. It's really hot. Thank you. Bring me some ice. I think my baby's getting me some ice water. Phyllis says thanks. Thank you. Whew. I want to thank our Al-Anon speaker. And, Keith gave a great talk last night, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's always a privilege and an honor to share in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm always very grateful that I get to share at this level. And, to tell you the truth, when I was newly sober and heard Chuck saying all them, I really wanted to be a main speaker all the time. So I really am grateful that that happened for me. I truly am. And I say that with humility, because I think it's, I'm a very blessed woman to be able to share in Alcoholics Anonymous and to be sober one day at a time. And our great sir, old timer here, glad to see you. And I had a great dinner with my friends last night, Cheryl and Duncan, and my new friend Dawn, and the night before we went to dinner with Phyllis and Jody and Jean, and Phyllis' sponsor. So it's fun to do those sort of fellowship in AA when you go to conventions. You know, it's really, really wonderful. And I feel very, I just feel really loved here. And I'm a really difficult person to love. And people that know that about me, they love me anyway. And I'm really grateful for those people in my life. I don't know. To tell you the truth, I did a talk in Reno. And they sent me the tape, but can you hear me in the back? Okay, if you can't hear me, raise your hand, okay? Because there's no sense in listening to a speaker if you can't hear it. So, you know, tell me to speak up, I'll speak up. I have a big mouth. And so I did this Reno tape, and I hadn't really heard it. And Phil was heading her car, and so we were riding around, and I said, "Oh, take my tape here." So I said, "I want to listen so I don't get the same story I gave in Reno." And unfortunately, I don't have that story. I love when I say in AA, the speakers say in AA, you know, if I knew I was going to be a speaker a lot, I would have did a bigger story. You know, I would have done more things to really give you more shit to laugh at about ourselves. And I love the drink. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I'm a real alcoholic. I'm a pansy when it comes to those drugs. And even though alcohol is a drug, you know, our primary purpose here is for Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I took me a long time to honor that tradition and to learn about that tradition, singleness of purpose. It took me a very long time to understand that. Because I used to send everybody to A, you know, no matter what the problem was. And I stopped doing that, you know, so got to keep AA for those of us who have drank the way we drank, so people can have some place to go when we're all gone. And I hope that as a member of AA, a long-term member, that, you know, I can honor that tradition and keep that going. You know, I started drinking when I was, I want to tell you about Reno because it's funny. I have good friends in Reno and helped with did part of the convention. And I had met Keith before, so I felt really at home going there. And they asked me to be the spiritual speaker. It just really fucking blew my mind. And, you know, I was swearing that I was going to clean up my act with my swearing, but for some reason I kind of go. And so I just feel that's God's will. And so if that offends you, I'm sorry, and you can tell me, you can take the resentment inventory at home tonight. Keep coming back. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know there's hundreds of meetings in any city you belong to. Even in the small rural town where I grew up was Streator, Illinois. And I say that because I was a hick, and that's the last thing I wanted to be. And, you know, I came to this little hicky area, and I grew up in this town, and I come from a family of six, and there was brothers, and I'm the next girl, and the first girl in that family, and I have a kid sister, and she's 4 years younger than me. And I was a great aunt yesterday. My namesake had another baby girl, and she's fine, and I was very excited. She's had a hard pregnancy, and I'm not even she's been pregnant. So I called her here about every hour, and finally when I called my sister yesterday at your dinner, and she goes, "It's a girl, she's fine." I said, "Okay, Grandma, later." So unfortunately, I forgot to have children. I didn't plan on it. I don't think I ever planned to be a dyke my whole life. It was like a period I was growing through, and it ended up to be my whole life, you know. I'm out before Stonewall, so when I realized that, I felt very fucking old. And I had these tapes and things on Stonewall, and I knew a lot of people that was in this film. It was on HBO once, or one of the cable channels, and I taped it. So every so often I drag it out and invite people over and we watch it, because there's a lot of AA people on this, and one AA member on that tape, she's passed away now, but she lived to be 40 years sober, and she had one hell of a story, and not only her drinking, but her whole life story was so, you know, so wonderful, and she's such a dynamite woman. I still miss her. And, so I started drinking when I was, I don't know. I tell you what, my mother used to put alcohol on my gums when I was a baby, and she used to give me alcohol so that I would settle down, because I was a brat. And she said, "I never stopped crying for 5 years." And that's sort of what she was saying. So, and then she said, "Oh my God, you're an alcoholic because I do that." I said, "No, I'm an alcoholic because I'm a pig. And I learned to drink like a pig, and I never stopped." And I have friends that we've been friends for 45 years, and we had a class reunion last July. I went to, there's several of us, and we're going to get together this January the 5th again and have some, just the women get together, about 5 or 10 of us. And we've known each other since we were in high school and grade school, and we just lost one of our friends just died 2 weeks ago, and it really pulled our little group closer together. And, you know, I used to say to these kids, you know, we see each other periodically every 2 years, we call every 5 years, it's not real frequent, but we have always kept in touch. And I said, you know, out of all of us that I ran around with, I just don't understand how it's being the lesbian and the alcoholic. Because we don't know about the first stop, but we stopped drinking, and you didn't. You all drank like I did, you know. They said, but we stopped. So I said, oh, that's probably the problem. You know, once I started, I never wanted to stop, no matter what, where I was or where I was drinking. And I was a party girl. I liked drinking bars. I had time in bars. And You know, I had a lot of friends, and in the place I grew up, I was very well liked, and people really liked to drink with me, and we had a lot of fun. I really did. And, you know, we used to break into the country club swimming pool, and, you know, that's when we used to wear high heels. And can you imagine that? And, and I went to run across this golf course in our high heels. Can you imagine all this fucking damage? And then we tore off our clothes and jumped the fence and jumped into the pool. Now, I wasn't like 16. I wasn't like 17. I was like 26 years old. So, you know, this shit was going on as if I was 15 years old. And we did shit like that all the time. So, you know, my alcoholism didn't get me in much trouble because I was in that area. My brothers were all friends of the police. And whenever they picked me up, they'd go, isn't your name Leo? I'd go, yeah. And they go, isn't your brother Vince? And I'd go, yeah, because my brother went to school at Moses Guys. And then they'd say, well, we're going to drive you, you know, follow you home. And I'd say, okay, you know, or here, move over, I'm going to drive. Or, you know, what would your father say if we took you home in the squad car? Or, you know, whatever. And they'd try to scare me, and they'd take me home. When I moved to California, the same thing happened, because years ago, thank God, well, I don't know, but I am grateful I never went to jail. And, because I was jail waiting to happen. And, you know, and I got picked up in Burbank, the cop even drove me home, followed me home, and, you know, that don't happen anymore, thank God. I think it you know, it knocks us out of our denial when we get that DUI. You know, nothing's going to wake you up more than staying in jail. Like, whoa, I think I'm really in trouble. Not, you know. So I was very fortunate that I ran away from home when I was 27 years old. I had left earlier, but I had left earlier when I was 19, but I ran back home because my brother was killed, and my brother's guilt me into coming back. They said they'd take care of my mother, but she was having a nervous breakdown, and my mother was grieving. You know, we were high drama in my family because we had all these alcoholics. My mother didn't drink. My father did. My father drank until he was 89 years old, and he smoked too, and, you know, I don't know how they did that. So anyway, I'm just going to jump into how I got to it. You know, I'm the kind of drunk that back there in this small town, you know, we ran around. The one particular thing that stands out, it took me about 10 years to remember this incident. The one particular thing is that I really like to dress up, and I always like to dress and look good. No matter, I couldn't have a dime in my pocket. I used to go out with no money and never, you know, be drink all night and get drunk. I did that all the time. I ran around with guys that were millionaires, that were farmers. They were Irishmen, and they were all 10 and 15 years older than me. They were a good friend of my father's, and they took care of me, and I drove them. I was always a designated driver, because they were much more drunk than I was. And so I never had to worry about getting drinks, because if I went into a bar anywhere in my area, they'd sit them up. You know, if you're from a small town, that's what they do. I mean, you have six or seven drinks sitting up in front of you, and you never buy a drink when you left. You never buy anybody a drink, and you just drank and drank and drank, and, you know, until you fell off the bar stool, you staggered out the door and drove home. And I used to drive like this. I used to open my, I had a Mustang. It was really fast. And I used to go on the freeway to see if it would go from, how fast I'd go from 0 to 60 just for fun in the country. And of course, when I was driving, I couldn't see the road, so I'd have to open the door. So, yeah, we'd drive in, and I'd watch them all by the white line. So I wasn't going to have to. I was also, some of you identify this, I'm a car jumper, I know we have the car jumpers here, you know, I also was push people out of cars, and, you know, the story I was going to tell you first, then I tell you about my car jumping days, this one particular time I went to the bar, I was dressed up, I had on these really nice green stretch pants, that's when they were really big in the 60s, and I had some really expensive shoes on, I had on like a $150 sweater I got, and, and I went, you know, looking good into the bar and to the area where we all hung out. And a friend was there, and we proceeded to drink. And nobody really came in that night. And so I don't know what she said to me or what I said to her. She threw a drink on me. So I threw a drink back. And she threw one on me. So I said to the bartender, who was Katie, I never remember this woman's name. I said, Katie, why don't you just start serving us water? And so we kept talking, they kept throwing these drinks on each other, and We went Friday, we were just discussing this issue, but we had to drink on each other. So, I don't know what the hell we were discussing. Something ludicrous, I'm sure. I can imagine two drunken women sitting there. And, you know, so, finally, I decided I was going to go home, and I forgot I didn't have a car. And so I fell out the door, all pissed off at her, and I got out, and it started to snow a little, like sleet snow. And so I didn't live that far, maybe 2 miles, so I said, oh, you know, I'm young, in my 20s, what the hell. I said, I'll walk, screw her. And, you know, so I started walking, and, you know, I get by the Amtrak, it was at Santa Fe then, and I could hear the train coming way down, like, woo, so I'm walking, and now I have to pee. And I go, woo, and the train's coming, woo, so I go, I gotta beat this goddamn train. So I start running, and of course, I didn't beat the train, I peed my pants, so... Now the snow, I was all wet from coming out when we dropped it over, you know. So all the snow was starting to stick to me all over, you know. Now the sweater was really big and it was wool. And it was getting heavier because the snow was so big. So I was walking somewhat like this, you know. So I waited for that train to go by. And I had to walk maybe another half a mile down to where I lived. And like I'm walking and, you know, all fucked up. And I go in the back door. My mother, I never waited up for me, but I lived with my parents until I was 27 years old. It's very embarrassing, but I did. And so I get inside. For some reason, she's at the back door, which she had never done. She goes, so what happened here? I said, oh, I just got stuck in the, you know, out there in the snow. She said, you better go to bed. I said, I am. And, you know, my eyelashes were full of ice, and the ice was, like, on my cheeks, you know, and I was walking, like, crunch, crunch, crunch. I thought it was cool. I forgot I wet my pants by then. But, you know, that happened more than once, you know, continuously, you know, and trying to be with really wonderful women who were supposed to be straight, but you knew they were, you know, closeted dykes. And, of course, I was out and they wouldn't tell me. And I got mixed up with closeted dykes that wouldn't come out. Did that piss you off? And, you know, you'd be out, but they'd never come out with you years ago. And then, you know, 20 years later, they go, oh, well, I knew you were gay because I am. I said, oh, well, fuck you. And, keep me in that misery by myself all those years, you know. Like, I need to hear that, you know. And, so, you know, it just went on like that. It was endless, continuous, you know, drama, you know, just Mickey Mouse shit. I never gotten any trouble. The person came to jail was, you know, the cop did pick me up this one time. He did take me to jail. He took me to the captain's office. He called one of my brothers. My brothers were all 12, 15, 17 years older than me. And my brother came down. That brother came down to get me. It was 23 years old. I had more time. But he came down to get me, and he said to me at the station, I don't want this ever to happen again. You know, when he clenched his teeth and talked to his lips, I knew I was in trouble. Because this man was very passive, so he was always a jolly drunk. He never got in any trouble. He just used to drink, out, you know, fall down, and take care of him. You know, so, you know, that's the kind of stuff that happened to me, just mediocre, but continuously ongoing, nonstop alcoholism. And you know what I didn't know, and I didn't learn until I was 8 years old, I didn't know that blackouts are the beginning. I always thought blackouts was like the end sign of your drinking. Blackout drink is the beginning of sign of drinking. And, you know, that blackout drinking for me started very early on. And so if you've had blackout drinking, I mean, I'm sorry, but you're one of us. And you can try to get out of this. You know, the book says, you know, go down to the close bar, you know, have a few drinks and see if it's going to work for you. And then it says, you know, our hats are off to you. And, you know, my group used to say, you know, don't let the door hit you in the ass going out. And, you know, I come from a tough Radford group in the Valley, and they were no-nonsense men. And, years ago, there was a lot more men than women, and the women were very, very, great. The women were very, very, what's the word, sparse. And so it's like all the men were jumping on the podium all the time. The women, you know, I don't know if you ever go to straight women's studies or discussion women's studies where there's men and women in a discussion meeting. How many times do you see a straight woman raise her hand? It's almost never. I watch them just for fun. I'm like taking a survey. And, take a very real survey of how a straight woman acts in, you know, AA. And they're very afraid to share and raise their hand and share most of them. And most of the time, you know, I don't find that with us dykes, because, you know, hardly anything scares us. more the straight women, somewhat timid, but that's not a general rule, it's just what I've observed. It's just Mary's rule. If I say anything here, you know, it's my opinion, it's not based on anything else but my own observations. I would like to keep it to my experience, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen tonight. So that stuff went on, and then I ran home, ran away from home when I was 27 years old. And what I did, I always worked, I always had a college, you know. Of course, Mama always helped me out, you know, my mother. And I was very meshed with Mama, a total meshment. I was a surrogate husband, and I took care of her, and my father was always absent. And he was absent in ways, he was emotionally absent, but he was there physically. And my sister sent me this picture this week, and my family loves to dress up, and I love them about. I love that about them. They all dress up. So it's like Magdalene said. My sister's name is Mary Magdalene, and I am Mary Margaret. Okay, so you know where I'm going with this. So then I had that on my shoulders, this Catholic Catholicism stuff, and I mean I was a really good kid in school. And I wasn't that bright. I was a C average student always, but I always tried really hard. I was good with the nuns, and you know, I protected my sister all through school. And you know, the nuns were always on her fuck case. I don't know why, but they were. They was always after this kid, and she was just very quiet and bashful. And for some reason, they just gave her a really bad time. She missed a lot of school because she they didn't go to school. I don't know where I'm going. That's my train of thought. Oh, well. Doesn't really matter. We all got another 20 minutes to stay here till we're done. You put up with me no matter what I say. That's why I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to, like, you know, be on or be this or be that. And I love AA because I can be myself. I love Alcoholics Anonymous because my whole life I wanted to be myself. And, you know, that's why, in some instances, I'm not asked to speak in a lot of places, because what you hear and see here is what you get at all times with me. You know, I'm a no-bullshit kind of, I learned that in AA, and I'm sure I had some of that personality when I came, but I was never able to do it. I was a sniveling, kiss-ass, people-pleaser drunk. Sniveling, kiss-ass, dishonest people-pleaser. And I would have done anything to please you and never tell the truth about how I really felt. And AA has given me the ability to speak up and say who I am and what I stand for and what's going on with me. And a lot of times I'm wrong, and I can be wrong today. You know, I can be wrong and change and grow and move on. And I'm really grateful that I've learned so much in Alcoholics Anonymous about how to live. Because I was clueless when it came to living. I didn't know anything about living or anything about being a person. I didn't know anything about what went on. When people talk about what went on inside them, that was so foreign to me. And, you know, I didn't understand any of the inner work they used to talk about or any of that. It just was like, what? Huh? What? I was so dense, you know. And I was pretty dense, I thought, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what time did I start? I don't care. I'll go another 10 minutes. So, anyway, you know, I was very dense about stuff. But this is important for identification for people, because I think it's important for me to try to tell my story so that some in the room that is like this will identify with this and get it for themselves. I came from a background of being very religious. Like I said, I'm Mary Margaret, my sister's Mary Magdalene, and you know, it goes out and gets worse from there. And my mother was very into her Catholicism, and I love the Catholic Church, and I always wanted to do the right thing. And I mean, I didn't rebel till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And once I started to get the fun, I couldn't stop doing it here. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the fence. It's just it doesn't take you out of here. You know, you can be as defiant as you want here. You can be as resentful as you want here. Don't drink. You can be as happy as you want. Don't drink. You know, you can be whatever you want here. Don't drink. That's what we do. We don't drink. You know, and eventually you'll come to new realizations by working the steps. You'll find out who you are, and some of your behavior will drop away, and some of it will never leave you. My anger has never left. You know, I've been looking at my anger for 26 fucking years. It's still here. You know, it's still here. My anger is just below the surface a little bit. Piss me off, and I'll tell you. You know, I just, I mean, we were talking at the restaurant, and we were talking together. I heard Julie and I over the weekend. I don't know where we were, but she said something about. And she said, "Well, you're like bristly." And I said, "Bristly? I'm not that I am is bristly." She goes, "Oh, I didn't mean to offend you." I've never been so funny. I'm bristly. Yeah, it's like a bear. You know, and I thought it was so cute the way she described it, because I have this tendency to scare people off when I don't mean to, and I have this tendency to have a very hardcore exterior and not let very many people in, and I don't even know I'm doing that, and it's taken me years. I mean, Mike Venturi has known me the whole time he's been sober. I knew him when he was new, and I've known Grady about 10 years. I met Grady like in 88 or 89, and you know, when I have history friends that have known me for a long time, I don't have a problem with that. But in the beginning, I don't relate in a gentle, loving way to people. That's just, I don't. I just don't. I wish I knew how to do that, but I don't. I mean, I can terrify you in one fucking minute. And I was trying to be very gentle when I met Dawn. And I said, "Don't fuck up now. She's 3 years sober. Give the woman a fucking break. You know, she's worked her whole life. She's not some winky-dink kid here." And I was trying to be real respectful with her when I was trying to 12-step her, you know. And because I can just be awful. I mean, I just be brutally awful. And Phyllis is raising her hand back then. You know, Phyllis called me Phyllis has had a hard time getting sober. We've been friends for 10 years. I've sponsored her off and on. And she's lived with me, and she hasn't lived with me, and she's run off and come back, and she's been in and out of my life. And finally, you know, I don't know much about Al-Anon. I do try to go to Al-Anon. I work in Al-Anon program. I do consider myself a double winner, and I'm sort of like a weak, wimpy Al-Anon person still. And but the only way I know how to detach from people is by, hello, Phyllis? No, I'm not talking to you anymore. Come on. Well, that's the way I detach, you know. I mean, I don't detach in a loving, gentle way, you know. It's like, you know, I generally would say to Phyllis, she'd go, "Mary, this is Phyllis, how are you?" Real sweet. And Phyllis is very sweet. She's got the sweetness that I wish I had. She's very sweet, she's very polite, she's very, you know, just, I mean, I love that about her. Because I'm not, you know. And I aspire to that my whole life, but I don't think that's going to happen now. You know what I mean? It's 26 fucking years, this is it. This is what I get, you know? And I always thought I had this vision where I'd be sweet and cuddly and very nice and all that. I'm not that, you know, I'm not that. And so anyway, Phyllis called, she goes, you know, "Hi, this is Phyllis." I go, "Yeah, are you sober?" What does that have to do? "Are you sober, Phyllis?" "I will try." She goes, "But I'm goodbye." And I hung up on her. Now, this kid called me like that for 5 or 6 years. Off and on. So finally she called, and she said, "Mary?" I said, "Yeah." She said, are you sober?" She said, "Yeah, I have a year." I said, "Hell, a fucking year." You know? She said, "Now will you talk to me?" And I said, "Yeah," because I couldn't watch her kill herself. She's a very secure. I couldn't watch her self-destruct anymore. It was killing me. And that's the way I have to detach. I don't know another way to detach. I wish I did, you know, but I don't. I had another friend that drank who was, you know, he was 10 years sober, and my best friend really in the last 10 years. And he went out, and he's been out, and I had to let go. I got the AA notches in a car, and, you know, we had cell phones, and they were calling me on the cell phone, and they locked him in the back seat of the car, and I directed him to the hospital in a minute. You know, we did this whole kidnapping thing, and we could hear him screaming. And he was screaming on the phone, "Is that fucking dyke on the cell phone? Is that where the phone carrier to take me?" You know, he was screaming and jumping. He goes, "I'm going to jump out." But, you know, today we can't jump out back of the seats because they have locked doors, you know. You can't get out of cars anymore. It's a fucker for alcoholics, you know. You can't like jump out of the car, you know. You can't push somebody out like I used to, you know. And, you know, my mother pissed me off around the 405, you know, we'd go down, she'd say something to me coming from drinking, and I'd say, "What?" I'd lean over and go, "I'm a car! I'm a car! I'm a fucking car!" Go out, you know, and I'd roll up. 2 o'clock in the morning, you know. And I'd get home, and I'd go, "Well, I wonder where she is." And I do that, you know. And I'd start worrying.
saying, you know, that I did this, and I'd worry, and I'd stay up all night, and lay, and smoke a lot of cigarettes, and drink coffee, and then she'd come in at 7 a.m., and I'd go, where are you fucking been? How did I lay like that? And I was crazy, and I was a batterer drinking, I battered this woman, all time, and women are batterers. I was a really bad batterer. You know, and we're still friends today. She's my oldest friend here in California. We've 32 years of being friends. And, you know, she had 17 at one time, and she drank with one drink, and she came back, and she called me, and she goes, Mary, I need to tell you something, and I want to tell you something first before, you know, it comes to the A grapevine. And I said, what? Because I never in 100 years thought that she would drink. She said, I drank in Palm Springs. I start crying. I mean, I got so upset. It hurt me so bad that she lost. This woman is a terrible alcoholic like myself. I'm so afraid when we relapse. As long as we don't get back. Thank God she did. She had that one drink of champagne. She jumped in her car and drove home. And of course, she went down there. I won't tell her story, but she went there chasing a woman. So, you know, we do insane motherfucking shit sober. I mean, we ought to do anything sober, believe me. Self-restraint is not at the top of our list for most of us. Now they have it in the book, you know. So anyway, you know, I got with the help of God's grace, I met some women in AA, and I really chased this woman that I was after in AA. And thank God she was sober. And so I got sober, and I went to Radford, and, you know, Terry's been to that group. And, I mean, this group is, you know, if you think I'm nuts, you should have been there. I mean, they're like, well, years ago, you know, we didn't have treatment centers, and if people fell down, I think this is really great history, people didn't know this. We didn't have treatment centers. You went, like, right off to a treatment center and get your little Valium and withdraw politely, you know, what we did, you know, like, politely withdraw them, give them a little shoddy poo. Let them go to sleep now with their Valium, you know. We shook like this in the meetings, you know, and that's how I got sober. And sitting on my hands shaking, the AA's coming by, and I had a chiropractor in my house and work on me in my bed because I had alcoholic paralysis so bad I could hardly walk. And, you know, so, you know, and the people would fall down with seizures in the meeting. This is the truth. They fall down with a seizure in the meeting. You'd reach over, get your wallet, and stick it in their mouth, and watch what they were breathing, listen to the meeting, and they would start to arouse themselves. You'd take the water. We'd, like, pick them up. So I'd say, get them a glass of water. We'd put them back in the chair, and they'd sit through the rest of the meeting. We did it all the time. And if they were really bad, we might call the ambulance. And, you know, so I've seen alcohol at its worst. And I think today, it's really sad today because how many people go on 12-step calls and see what's really going on out there? It's not pretty, folks, to be. The ones that I knew are very close to their disease, so they know what it was like to drink like that. And I don't want to ever forget what it was like for me to drink. Drinking took away everything from me. I mean, it took away my, my self-pride and, the self-esteem I had built in wasn't much, but it was all I had at the time when that went, and took away my connection with my family only because I was so into my disease and my resentments with my brothers, and, you know, drove me away from them, and I fled, you know, 2,000 miles away to get away from my family and to come someplace else so that I thought that I wouldn't be drinking in California. That's why I left my area, because the drinking was too much with my friends. Also, I wasn't married. I knew that there was something wrong with me, and I didn't quite have a name for it. And on one of the freeways, I went, oh, I think I'm one of those lesbians. You know, when I got that on the freeway, like I drove faster to California and found the first blonde I ran into. And that was the one that I just drank. And I was with her 5 years through terrible, terrible insanity. I mean, crazy. Battering stuff that is very painful and still talk about today. When I think about how many times I had to talk about that battering and me throwing out of the car, and you know, one time I tried to jump out of the car in Hollywood Fray, and you know, she had a hold of my coattail, and my head was like this far from the ground, and she's doing 70 miles an hour on the freeway. Now, I mean, I don't know how I'm alive, you know what I'm saying? And I go, let go of me, I'm out of here, you know. To me. I don't want to live anyway. Let go. You know, and, you know, just, we were just pathetic, both of us.
we were just lost. I heard on my other tapes that it's really the truth is, I was so lost and lonely. I got so very, very lost. And I got so far from a power greater than myself that by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, the first Marine I came to, I didn't remember the Lord's Prayer. And I was brought up Catholic, and I was a good Catholic, and I was a very religious sort of person until alcohol took a hold of me, and I stopped practicing my faith when I came here, and I never really had any sense of God. I always got so angry at God for killing my brother that was killed in a car accident, and I was pissed off at my brothers. I just was very pissed off, and I was just very, very angry. And so I just felt really, really awful. And at that first meeting, when I could not remember the Lord's Prayer, I said, "Oh my God, what's happened to me? What's happened to me? What happened?" You know, and I started to cry, and I know I surrendered that night. It hasn't been necessary for me to drink for my first meeting. That's just my story, but the desperate alcoholic that I am, I know that can be anyone's story. It can be your story if you're new. If you're new in this room tonight, and this is your first meeting, or you've relapsed and you're back, and this is your first meeting again, the book says that we don't ever have to drink again if we don't want to. You know, and I don't want to. And it hasn't been necessary. It's been necessary for me to drink, believe me. It's been very necessary to drink. Very, very necessary. You know, and I don't. I don't drink. I don't drink, and that's the message that you get, is that we don't drink here. We don't drink in between meetings. You know, we go to a meeting every day if you're new, and if you're new, you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. The basic Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you're probably wondering how most of us that have a lot of time have stayed here this long, and I'll give you what the example is, what that is. The big fucking secret is we go to meetings, we don't drink, we work newcomers, and we go insane sometimes. And we go fucking crazy, we call our sponsors, we call some of our best friends, we get ill, our life changes, we get injured, we have life crises, and we just keep, just keep loving along. I don't have any other choices. My choice is to stay sober, always. Well, that's not a choice. The book talks about that not being a choice. I believe that. But I need to do all the basic claims that I learned in my first year of what has kept me sober for 26 years. Nothing has changed. I read the book. I go to meetings. I share. I pick people up when I can for meetings. I attend conference meetings when I have the strength to now. You know, I talk to people on the phone. I call my friends to see how they are. I call my family to see how they are. And I try to keep out of myself. Because if I don't get out of myself, especially in the kind of condition I am today, I mean, it doesn't take me long than to be laying in that bed, and by one or two in the afternoon, I'm going, but maybe I should get up now. and the pain's so awful, I go, maybe I, and I have to get up, and I have to get the phone up and say, to some, one of my eight friends, I just got up, I'm fucked, I'm totally fucked, I'm so depressed, I can't stand it, and, but I'm going to get ready and get my breakfast. And I'll never forget. I got best information in my first year always from my sponsor. I was having these nervous breakthroughs when I was new. And the first year I fell totally apart the first 3. So I just kept falling apart. And I kept being really crazy and really crazy. And because I was crazy. I do suffer mental illness, but that's another story. So, and I always thought I was different because of my mental illness in AA, and I always thought that there was something terribly wrong with me, and I was different from everybody in AA too, and that used to really make me crazy. And I finally have accepted my mental illness. I've done something about it. I'm very grateful that I did that. It took me 23 years to take care of that. I don't like to talk about that, but people need to know that if you've got other problems, you take care of them. The book says we go see the doctors, we see psychiatrists, we go to people that can help. Let's go do that. Go do that. But first off, work the steps, I worked the steps for 22 years and didn't quit my mental illness. I went to a psychiatrist. And I've gone years before and not taken their direction. And so I'm very, very grateful that God has given me the courage to give up my suffering. God has given me the courage to give up my suffering. And I no longer have to suffer from mental illness. Now I don't have to feel different from all of you anymore. And I have to feel like I'm not enough. And so what's wrong with me? And how come people 5 years sober are growing and they're working and they're very successful? And here I am again, struggling, lost another job, went insane at work, got fired again, on and on and on. That's my story. Terry knows my story. On and on and on. And it was relentless and it never changed. It never changed. So I finally had to address my mental illness. And I'm really glad I did that. And you know, the steps work, but they don't work on mental illness. So, and I always thought it was going to. I always thought it was going to work on a mental illness. I had thought that Jesus, God Almighty, was going to cure my mental illness. It didn't. And, but it really helps with everything else. And it's changed my life drastically, the steps. And I feel very grateful that, you know, I haven't had the drink. That, you know, the steps help us from drinking, not the drink. They help us from not drinking. The steps take care of our alcoholism, and they can also take care of a lot of other problems. And the biggest thing the steps has given to me is a power greater than myself. And that's what it guarantees in the book. It says if you do these certain things, you will have a power greater than yourself to deal with. And that's what I got from working the steps. And what else can I ask for? I got a power greater than myself that takes care of me no matter what. No matter what, you know. And the latest thing that I had to work through, some of you know and some of you don't know, is that I fell 17 feet. I was paralyzed from the neck. I'm only telling this because of God's power. I was paralyzed from the neck down. They said I wouldn't walk again. I was quadriplegic, and it goes on and on and on. And you know, I walk today, and I have it's difficult. And you know, I do the best I can. I do the best I can with what I got today. And I'm not so hard on myself, and therefore I'm not so hard on others. I've tried my whole sobriety not to be hard on others, and I had to learn how to do that by falling 17 feet. It's pretty fucking pathetic, isn't it? And, so whatever I get out of my injury, I've got a lot out of my injury. I've come to have a lot of quiet time alone with myself. I couldn't be alone with myself when nothing else could stop me. You know, and some of the things you talked about with self-destructive behavior, I have all of them. I love Speedy. You know, when I first was injured, I didn't drive my first year, and I got my license back, was able to drive. I went, I was driving like within the speed limit, and I was moving along. I said, wow, this is what normal people do. I'm so comfortable driving, like slow, taking it easy, you know. Of course, now I've gotten more hyper again, so now I still go 65 in 3-mile-an-hour zones, and I want to be nuts on the freeway, and I almost had an accident with my niece, and she was out here because of my compulsive, obsessive behavior, my driving, and my inability to stop myself, and, you know, but all those things I have to surrender and give up. I have to ask God to help me because I am powerless over my behavior. I'm powerless. I'm powerless over my anger. I'm powerless over what you do. I'm powerless over what I do. I am powerless over people, places, and things. I'm powerless over my sister who's got scleroderma. I'm powerless over my niece who's bipolar. I'm powerless over my other niece who's bipolar. I'm powerless. I cannot help them. I'm powerless. I can only help myself. I can only watch what I do and correct my behavior. Watch what I do, correct my behavior. And I love what you said, too, about not giving advice or whatever Al-Anon says about, you know, pointing shit out to people. I do that all the time. Well, you should do this, and you should do that, and why don't you do it this way? You know, baby cars, it's like I jump on their fucking ass before I even know what's going on with them, you know? That's not right. You know what I'm saying? And I try to do less of that. You know, I try to say, well, what's going on, honey? And I'm changing my behavior. Not being such an asshole here. And, because the only way I could have stayed sober with the kind of person I was to kick my own ass. And I did a lot of ass kicking. And, you know, the book says we're hard on ourselves and easy on others. But unfortunately, I've always been hard on myself and hard on all you. And I've always tried to correct that, but I'm not very good at it. But I've done better. I've done better. I've become a more loving person because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't think that was ever going to happen to me, to tell you the truth. I really didn't. I really didn't. And I was of service a lot, and... you know, but you have to be careful because two-stepping can go on for years. That's what it says in the 12 and 12. And I didn't want to do it, so I did a lot of two-stepping for years, and I never looked at myself. And, you know, so the journey always comes back to me. It always comes back to me to take my own inventory, to do 10 steps at night. You know, the art of 10 steps is gone in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't hear it. I may not be here, but where I live and the meetings I go and the people I talk to, most people don't take 10 steps and do resentments and fears. And I'm amazed at that people don't know that. I'm amazed what little people know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it's just, and I'm not being judgmental about that. What I'm saying is it hurts me. It hurts me that people don't have the message, that people don't know how these steps work, that they don't know how to work them, that they're not getting the help they need. You know, and why is that? It's because we have grown so big that, you know, some people have fallen through the loopholes. And they're sober, but they're very uncomfortable. And you don't have to live that way. You know, I had a boss who was totally abusive with me and right before my injury. I loved my job, and I loved where I lived, and I was really having a good time at work. And I had to come home every night and do a 10-step on this man. Then I had to call somebody, read it on the phone. But I was 23 years sober then. I do that work all the time, no matter what. You know, if you're going to call me, I'm going to give you a solution. I'm going to have you write it out and call me back immediately. You know, I told my babies that. I tell them to write out and call me back immediately. I never hear from them again. What the hell is up with that? What is up with that? What is up with that? You know, I would call Marie Stinner if I even know Marie and, you know, complain to her. And Marie said, here, write, Marie would take my inventory. And she'd say, well, you resent this and you resent that and you resent that. She would tell me how I feel. And then she'd say, this is your fear. You fear this and you fear that and you fear this. She said, okay, honey, now you go write that down and you call me back. Now, she talked to me that when I was 20 years sober. I wasn't new. You know what I'm saying? So I'd go in, I'd get my little pen at 20 years sober, and I'd go, I resent so-and-so because, and I resent, you know, I took my inventory. Because I don't ever want to drink or use again. I don't want to drink. I'll do anything not to drink. I will. I'll do anything not to drink. And a lot of things have fallen away from me. You know what I'm saying? I've changed in many, many ways. I have self-restraint that I never thought I'd have, you know? And I have a restraint of tongue and pen where I can walk away from most instances, no matter how bad someone may piss me off, you know. And I'm really grateful for that. I don't have to have the last word anymore, you know. And I don't have to be right all the time, because I love to be right. So does Cheryl. We love to be right. And, you know, we're talking about that the other night at dinner. I love to be right, you know, like, aha! Got you that time, I was right. You know. I love being right, you know. And, so I have to be right anymore a lot of the time. Not most of the time, a lot of the time. Some of the time. Well, so, every so often. And it was talking a bit about, I'll stop here in 2 minutes. We was talking a bit, I need to share this because I think it's important for me and it's important for people that I, you know, everybody has, you can work this program your own way, truly, as you can, but you do need a mentor, you need a sponsor, you need a guide, whatever you want to call that person. Go to a priest, go to a minister, go to a rabbi, you know, go to Buddha, you know, get some into the Hindu religion, whatever it takes. Go to your psychiatrist, go to your therapist, but get a guide. Get a guide who's going to take you through these steps, especially through the fourth step and the fifth step. And do the work. You have to do the work. And you just can't say, aha, oh, I did step four and five, now I'm done, you know, and, you know, I think the first three steps are easy. You're powerless over alcohol, your life's manageable, you're nuts, turn it over, off you go. It's all right. That's what they told me. They said, Mary, are you powerless over alcohol? Uh-huh. Is your life manageable? Uh-huh. Can you turn that over? Uh-huh. And they said, to some other power? Uh-huh. They said, you know, so they said, so? Still writing. I said, oh, okay, and I don't know why I'm still writing. And I did my inventory in my first 4 or 5 months of sobriety. And I did a fifth step, and it wasn't the best, but I did it. I had to start somewhere. And I was saying this on my other talk. So I had this, the scariest thing for me was to look within. The scariest thing was to look within. And I never knew the power of that until it talks about in the fourth step in the 12 and 12. It talks about our defiance and how we won't look at ourselves. It talks about how our defiance keeps us from God and how our way doesn't work and what we need to do to find God through these steps. It talks about all that. I have to open myself up to a power greater than myself. You know, and what flashed my mind this hour is that, you know, I'm going to end with this. I was sober a long time, and I spoke somewhere. Don't know where. I don't know who the person was. I don't know who I was. And I talked, and this is a little part of my talk. And I said, you know, when I was newly sober, this white light came into my room, and it followed me. It followed me for a few days. And I went to my sponsor, and he was an ex-priest. Thank God. The only guy I would have trusted. I would only trust an ex-priest. And I wouldn't go to the priest because I didn't think they were like gays. So, you know, I went to this guy and I said, you know, he said, what? I said, I got this this light. You know. He said, following you? I go, yes. I said, what do you think it is? He goes, oh, Mary, it's all right. You know, just sort of follow you, you know. And I told this at a convention or some small talk or something I gave. And when I got off, we have a tradition in L.A. where people come up and thank the speaker. But more so than anything like that, I don't want you to leave without me hugging somebody that was here. So, you know, at the end of the meeting, I hope that you come up and I get to hug you. And this woman said, I got off the podium and she came up to thank me. And she said, Mary, did you ever let that white light in? I said, no. By then I was 16 years sober. So Alcoholics Anonymous has let me let the light in. It's let me let God into my life. And it took me a long, long time. And I hope that if you're new, it won't take you that long. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.